Hi, my name is Richard Cho. I cover Canadian communications for J.P. Morgan. I want to welcome Tony Staffieri, CFO of Rogers Communications. Thank you for being with us today. So starting out, a real differentiator for the Canadian communications companies right now versus the U.S. companies, Canada is seeing some real strong, both postpaid subscriber and service revenue, ARPU growth. Can we first go over kind of what you're seeing in terms of subscribers and customer loadings after 2 years where things were not as good over the past few quarters? It seems like there's been real growth and not just stuff like tablets or home phone type of stuff.
Sure. Well, first off, let me say thank you, Richard, for having Rogers here. We appreciate the opportunity. Maybe before I get into some of the aspects of service revenue and ARPU, might be helpful, particularly for those not familiar with Rogers in Canada, to provide a little bit of context. Rogers is one of the largest telecom players in the Canadian market. We're the largest national wireless player. We're also the largest cable player in the market, and we have a media business as well. That is the largest content owner of sports within Canada, either directly or through rights. So those are the spaces we play in. We recently gone through a CEO transition, and we now have a new CEO on board, Joe Natale. Joe joined us about 3 weeks ago. Joe comes to Rogers from one of our national competitors. And so he brings with him a wealth of experience and a proven track record. And so we're really excited to have Joe on board and can already see the potential for upside value on top of some of the recent success that we've been seeing in the marketplace. In terms of our overall framework within Canada, Canada continues to do well as an economy. Population continues to grow in the 2 to 3% range, GDP growth as well. And so, in addition to an expanding population, what you see is a healthy growth in consumer wallet share, if you will. On the regulatory front, we've had a new government in place for just coming on 2 years now, and I would say this government continues to show itself to be very thoughtful and strategic. About the industry, very much interested in facilities-based investments by the telecom players. Some recent decisions, in particular on MVNO, it's clear that they're not interested in that type of construct for the Canadian market. And so I would say the regulatory front continues to be stable and encouraging. And then finally, within Rogers, we've gone through a bit of a turnaround over the last several years, and what will have seen over the last several quarters is strong improvement in fundamentals, particularly in cable and wireless. And that's sort of leads into your question, Richard, and how we're seeing on the wireless side. Wireless traditionally in Canada has been growing postpaid subscribers at a rate of about 2 to 2.5%. Starting in about mid-2016, we've seen that rate of growth to 3 to 4%, and we continue to see the prospects for that continued wireless growth, the momentum to continue, at least for the next little while. Population growth is one contributor that I talked about. Wireless penetration in Canada still sits in mid-80s, and so there's quite a bit of room for upside growth on that front. Big drivers, a couple of things on service revenue. Data usage, just as you see anywhere else, has been the big driver. Grows, when we look at our customer metrics, grows anywhere from 35% to 45% year on year in terms of data consumption. And so the market, us included, has been fairly disciplined in converting that into healthy ARPU growth. In the last quarter, we reported blended ARPU growth of 2%. Our postpaid ARPU growth is just above that, and so we see ARPU growth being healthy from that perspective as well. We also see very strong ARPA growth as well, and so our Share Everything construct has been very useful in adding the number of devices, and that's helping the penetration rates that I talked about earlier come along, and they're additive. And in spite of the number of devices increasing, as I said, ARPU continues to increase as well.
So it seems like a lot of this growth isn't low-end, low-usage. It's higher-end, higher usage. And I think as your networks have gotten faster, have you seen data growth kind of pull that along and people take bigger buckets?
Yeah, so the phenomenon we've seen in Canada is not unlike you've seen in the U.S., and perhaps there's a bit of a time lag to it. But smartphone penetration continues to be healthy and robust. And as we look to the higher penetration of those smartphones, more and more of them, the majority of our traffic today sits on LTE, and that migration has largely happened. Not a lot left in terms of data traffic on 3G, except largely for machine-to-machine type of traffic. And so that piece of it is moving well and continues to be one of the biggest drivers of ARPU growth for us in the industry.
The Canadian wireless market seems a lot more overall stable than the U.S. market with four players versus the three, even though there are some regional ones. I think more the equal sizing of the companies are relative, more equal sizes versus two large players in the U.S. and two smaller ones in the U.S. How can you talk about the competitive environment in wireless? Because it seems like it's very competitive still, just not value destroying.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, Richard. I would say there's three incumbents that are well capitalized, and while there's always competitive intensity, particularly around certain periods or cycles in the calendar year, I would say a lot of that intensity is somewhat rational. We seem to all be focused on lifetime value economics. We're willing to invest in handset subsidies, provided that the LTVs are there. And so you continue to see that type of discipline, if you will, in the marketplace. As we look to some of the fourth player entrants that exist in the marketplace, I would describe them, for those of you not familiar, as predominantly regionally based. And so in each of the regions, we have a fourth player, very small share. But even when you look at the way they've been playing in the market, I would describe them as somewhat rational. They generally operate as a slight discount to the incumbents, but nowhere near the type of disruptive pricing that you've seen play out in the U.S. marketplace. Certainly when you look to our plans, we've been translating, and we are still largely on a subsidy model. As an industry, we've stayed away from equipment financing. We don't see that as long-term value enhancing, at least not right now. And so we continue to be on the subsidy model, and as handset costs have increased, I would say we and the industry has done a good job of translating that into higher ARPUs. And we see that with the fourth player entrance as well.
Churn has improved recently, and it's been incrementally getting better. Where do you think that can go? Do you think we could see sub 1% churn, which obviously would be very good and increase that lifetime value?
Churn's a big opportunity for us. We've always done well on the gross add side of the market, generally getting more than our fair share. Traditionally, on the gross add side, we've gotten 33 to upwards of 40% market share. And a lot of key advantages we have there, first of which is our distribution network on the gross add side. Of late, we've ramped up the focus on churn as a big value driver for us, given we have the largest wireless base in Canada. Churn improvements for us translate into much higher value than, say, our competitors. And so we've seen good progress. Last quarter, you would have seen churn at 1.10% churn, and very healthy improvement year on year. Is sub 1% possible? Absolutely. Is it achievable? We think so. And we think having someone like Joe on board that has a demonstrated track record of best-in-class churn improvements is going to bode well for Rogers. And so we think there's an opportunity. I would say 1% would sort of be our interim stake in the ground of what we'd like to get to. We're seeing other players, hovering around 0.9%. And so the bar keeps moving lower, and that's good for the industry, and our target will keep moving as well. But there's no structural reason that we can't ultimately achieve best-in-class churn for our sector.
I guess one thing in Canada is the spectrum positions seem to be more evenly spread out with continued growth, with increased data usage. How do you feel about Rogers' spectrum position, and when could we see a broadcast auction in Canada at some point?
Well, as you know, we're very comfortable with the spectrum position we have. We sit with a very healthy position. Coming out of the 700 spectrum auction, we did fairly well in terms of getting some of the key spectrum pieces that we were after. As we look to the next spectrum auction, the 600, hard to tell. The government hasn't announced anything definitive in terms of timeline. Just based on process and our reading of the tea leaves, we would estimate that probably not sooner than 2019 is when we can see the next spectrum auction. But given our success in the 700 in acquiring that low-band spectrum, we don't see the need to invest anywhere nearly as much as we did at the last auction in the upcoming auction. But it's still quite a few years out.
I guess it might be interesting to kind of go through your thoughts on how Rogers might approach 5G, mainly because you have a cable plant, you have a wireless network with strong backhaul. As you think about rolling out 5G or starting to trial it, what are Rogers' plans with 5G?
Yeah, well, two parts to the question. One is in terms of our plans for 5G. As many of you probably know, 5G is really an evolutionary network technology. So it isn't something that is going to replace 4G, but rather build on top of the 4G network that we already have. So as we look out, we think we're well positioned to implement 5G. We intend to fast follow on that. We've partnered with Vodafone and a few other large players in terms of following technology roadmaps on that. And as the standards for it solidify, I think what you can expect Rogers to do, just given our overall scale in the global world of wireless, we will slipstream behind where the industry is going and fast follow on 5G. And then the second part of your question is, how do we feel about backhaul capabilities on the 5G? We feel good and strong about where we're at with that. Today we have, as you would expect, good coax, but in particular fiber coverage in urban markets. And where we don't have it, there's a healthy process to buy, and when the economics make sense, we build. But in the overall scheme of the 5G roadmap, we don't see that as necessarily a problem nor a big CapEx investment for us.
I guess a lot of other companies around the world talk about having a quad play. You obviously could have a quad play and probably do have a quad play. Is it a significant portion of the business, or do people kind of really just separate the two? I know Quebecor has tried and Videotron have tried to tie it, but that's with a, I would say, disadvantaged wireless business, and it seems like it's being more driven by price, whereas you have a more robust wireless business in more areas. So is it an opportunity, or is it something that you'd rather keep separate?
Long term, we do see it as a big opportunity. As you said, we're fortunate in that we've been a quad play player for some time, having both wireless and cable. wireless being national for us and the cable footprint focused in the Ontario and Atlantic provinces. And so as the cable footprint gets bigger, there's better opportunity for overlap. I think you're right that quad play to date has generally been limited to a bundled price discount. There hasn't been a lot on what I would call the global product roadmap that would allow for a better user experience seamlessly between wireless and in-home cable. But we think that's yet to come. The other piece of it is, you know, what we do know is a key ingredient for an effective quad play is to have a very strong cable base and cable NPS. And so as we've made improvements on our cable front, particularly on internet, and soon with the launch of the Comcast X1 product for video, and the Xfinity Digital Home, we think that's only going to further our cable NPS, our cable customer loyalty, and the opportunities for quad play. So all of that to say is the upside for quad play is still there and hasn't really been exploited in the marketplace.
Given even with the recent rebound in subscriber adds, you know, obviously being helped by churn a little bit, margins continue to improve. What is the long-term margin outlook for Rogers, both for this year and maybe beyond, and what are you doing there to improve margin?
Well, we said, if you rewind the clock a few years, we said job one for us was to focus on revenue growth and subscriber growth. Together, it's with ARPU growth, and I think that's been coming in nicely. In mid-2016, the focus then shifted to translating more of that revenue growth to a healthy flow-through, and actually start to grow adjusted operating profit and margins as well. And you've seen that come in. I would say still lots of opportunity on margin expansion for us. Cost initiatives, while we've always done some, I would say has moved up on our priority list. And certainly you can expect, as Joe outlines his priority, that cost efficiency improvements is going to be high on the list. We see it as a significant value driver, you know, just as high as churn and customer experience improvements as well in the next little while. And so as you look to wireless, you can expect us to improve margins over the next 12 to 24 months from where they are today. I don't want to provide too much guidance on it, but we think it would be a material shift and return to where we've traditionally been in wireless margins. And similarly on the cable side, as more and more of our revenue comes from the higher margin internet, combined with cost improvements that we have on the roadmap for cable, we think cable is well poised not only for margin expansion beyond the 47% that it has today, but also cash flow growth as we move to get our capital intensity on the wireline side of the business down and more in line with industry norms over the next few years.
That was somewhere I wanted to go. Generally, I've always thought of Rogers as having 12, maybe 13% CapEx intensity on the wireless side, and that's come down significantly to about 10% last year. Is that a new level that we should expect? And it seems like it's being done without any sacrifice to investment in the network and speeds and customer experience.
Wireless capital intensity, the number that you saw for 2016 of just under 10% and an even lower capital intensity the last few quarters, I would describe it solely as timing. We think the right capital intensity number for wireless sits more in the 12 to 13% range, which is generally where you see the rest of the industry at. And so as you think about our cash flow and our capital allocation, think about intensity for wireless being more in that range.
Moving to the cable side, starting with a more of a macro view, in your cable footprint, what are you seeing in terms of household formation with population growth, and what are your opportunities generally within your footprint in terms of penetration and both with, maybe with video and broadband subscribers?
Yeah, well, on the cable side, our cable footprint is largely centered around the province of Ontario, which still is one of the fastest growing provinces in the country. And so our cable footprint naturally grows at about 2.5 to 3% a year. So it's healthy growth in terms of size of the market on the cable side. We've approached cable in a couple of ways. One is we wanted to focus on our natural competitive advantage, which as a cable operator has been on internet. What we know is the majority of households are now choosing their in-home service provider based on quality of internet, and that's our competitive strength. We started to execute aggressively on that in mid-2016, and it's been a big contributor to us to start to win back households. And so we're seeing subscriber and household performance that we haven't seen for 6 years since our telco competitor first started fiber builds in our footprint. And so that's giving us added traction, and it's coming with quality ARPU improvements as well. Internet ARPU for us continues to grow at a healthy 5 to 10% on average, and that's been our lead product on the cable side. As I mentioned, in the first quarter of 2018, we will launch the Comcast X1 video product, as well as the in-home digital Wi-Fi experience as well, and we think that will be the second leg of a product superiority on the cable side, and will only help us increase penetration, but also increase ARPA. So household ARPA for us has been growing of late, largely because of internet. But once we add to that a growing video ARPU, we think that's significantly going to help grow overall household ARPA as well.
In terms of the broadband service that you're leading with, what are most of the customers taking, and what kind of speeds are being offered, and how has that changed over time?
So our entire footprint is eligible for 1 gig of speed. We pass 4.2 million homes today, and all of those homes are eligible for 1 gig, as I mentioned. We've been very aggressive in promoting speeds out there. The average speed of our base is over 100 megs of speed. And so for our competitor, as they are still deploying FTTH, they generally cap out at 50 megs where they don't have fiber to the home. And so we see that as a big opportunity for us. And so we are seeing consumers not only taking the higher speeds, but they're willing to pay more for it. And as we improve the in-home experience, with the next generation of Wi-Fi modems, and as I said, the Xfinity digital home platform, we think that's going to give us a long-term competitive advantage. As the telco deploys fiber to the home, they can eventually, several years out, match us on raw horsepower. But we think when you combine that with the front-end X1 experience for video and digital home, that's going to be a difficult customer to unstick, and we think that's going to help brand loyalty for us.
So I assume it's a very big priority to get X1 out at the beginning of next year. How aggressive will you be in rolling it out, and what is the kind of ideal household that you're going to be going after in your markets?
Generally, I would say expect us to follow the Comcast Cox recipe for this. The one piece of advice that we got loudly and clearly was pace the demand for this in the early stages. So when we launch, the plan is to limit the volume on launch for about a quarter. And then as we perfect the processes, everything from the buy flows to the back end billing and any type of servicing that needs to happen, we want that process to be to meet certain quality levels that we've set for ourselves. And then once we've done that, then we plan to expand the launch of that. At a certain point in late 2018, early 2019, we will stop sell on our legacy product, And that will be the beginning of an aggressive move to move our cable base to all IP. Aspirationally, we think about late 2021 as a date to when we ought to be able to move to an all IP network on cable. And clearly that brings with it a number of cost and spectrum advantages for us.
And the version of X1 that you're launching is IP-based. What advantages does that have over Shaw's Blue Sky?
So the IP version, it's two things. One is from a cost perspective, it moves us more quickly to all IP. The CPE roadmap, or customer prem equipment, in the IP version continues to come down from what it is today in the hybrid version of X1. From a customer experience standpoint, the customer won't necessarily, if they're on the hybrid version, isn't going to see a big change at first. But as you would expect, the IP version is going to allow for a lot more flexibility and integration of new features such as YouTube. I mean, they already have Netflix integrated today, YouTube, and there'll be more to follow, I'm sure. And so as that happens, just the ease of integration is going to be much more user-friendly. And then, as I said, overall, from a cost perspective, it affords quite a bit of cost advantages relative to a hybrid model.
And I guess if people want to ask questions, please raise your hand. But moving on to the overall base, they'll get you a microphone. Video losses are getting less. Broadband continues to grow. With the launch of X1, I think you'll end up having cost advantages down the line. How should we think about where revenue will go for the cable business and then the longer-term margins, and you talked about wanting to improve them?
So in the cable business, what we've seen over the last three quarters is a return to growth overall. In our most recent quarter, you would have seen cable revenue flat year-on-year. That's what's included in there is a reprice, regulatory reprice that happened on the wholesale segment of the market, which is very small, but on a year-on-year basis, it had an impact and a full one-point impact. So if you were to exclude that, we actually have a cable business that has been growing and continues to grow. I was at 1%, and profitability would have otherwise been at 4% growth. So we expect those numbers to continue to head in the right direction on a go-forward basis, but it's been a healthy trend that we've seen on that front.
I think we have a question from the audience.
Could you talk about the incremental margins you're seeing on the broadband product and with the broadband growth that you described, and also how much capital intensity is associated with that?
So on the broadband side, as you would expect, the incremental revenue comes in at pretty close to 100% margin. There's very little what I would describe as OPEX. And so our cable margins are naturally helped by the mix shift to internet, as that more and more is the majority of our revenue and revenue growth. Video, on the other hand, would sit at roughly a 50% margin. So you can see how over time that will be a natural help to margin expansion on the cable side. The offset to that is capacity to support the data traffic that drives, and it largely comes in the form of segmentation. So fewer homes per node is the path we've been on, and we've been following a relatively consistent investment program, and we'll continue to follow that over time. And what we find is we've gotten a lot better at targeting CapEx to the neighborhoods where we're seeing the increased demand and the increased revenue. And so the one thing that we like and you all probably like about the CapEx model is it's an extremely efficient capital allocation program from an ROI perspective. And so we like the prospects that we see for ROI. Today, our capital intensity sits at just over 30%, which is high for cable. Two drivers for that. One has been the investment in IPTV. And given our abandonment of our own homegrown product, we're now making the one-time investment this year into the Comcast X1 implementation. After that, we moved to a variable cost model with Comcast. Notwithstanding that, we still see the opportunity for margin improvements. So it's not going to come at the expense of margin. And then the second piece is CPE. So in today's model, if you think about the average customer having just over two televisions, each one of those requires, on average, an HD PVR. And so average install for a home today for us is over $1,000. As we move to the X1, it will be sub $400. And so you can see how quickly that moves the needle on capital intensity. So those two will be the biggest driver. So we see ourselves, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves in terms of guidance, but over several years, you ought to expect us to move towards what you see the U.S. cable companies operating at in terms of capital intensity.
Okay, great. And just one more. Could you comment on the a little bit more on the churn? I think you mentioned at the beginning overall churn was 1.1 or so monthly. Could you talk about sort of the variation around that overall number and where you see the lowest, you know, for instance, where you see the lowest churn and the highest churn within the base?
Sure. So on the wireless side, I should preface it by saying we've seen churn improvements, healthy churn improvements on both the wireless and on the cable side. Even our video business, if we were to look at the last year and a bit, very healthy churn improvements there. The 1.10 that I mentioned was on the wireless side for the last quarter. As you would expect, share everything, or put another way, the higher end is where we're seeing the best churn performance. Just as a customer adds more devices, much like you've seen in the U.S., you see churn coming down on that side of it. All portfolios are seeing good churn improvement, even in the prepaid space. We're seeing healthy churn improvements there as well. We had a bit of an issue with a distributor in the first quarter on the prepaid side relating to commissions that we fixed, and so that's back on track. If you look at back on the postpaid side, the variations between what I call the full share everything and maybe a SIM-only customer, as you would expect, you see slightly higher churn on SIM-only, but even that churn rate has been coming down consistently over the last several quarters. So it's happening on all fronts, but the distribution is, as you would expect, across the spectrum on the value of the customer.
Can you go back a little bit to the 600 megahertz auction, your comments there? Can you talk about how much you actually feel like you need that spectrum? Obviously, there was different strategies by the big incumbents here in the U.S. as to how much they thought they needed, and arguably you guys have a more attractive spectrum position than the incumbents here. And I guess it's sort of a multi-part because to the extent that that auction goes forward and the incumbents don't necessarily need it that much, maybe that's an opportunity for a Shaw or somebody else to get pretty important spectrum for them. And if indeed that plays out, does that create a more interest on your part of creating a Bellis-like network across the various cable operators? So sorry for the long one.
Oh, a couple of parts to it. So let me try to go through them. You know, as we think about the 600, we've certainly obviously been watching how it's played out here in the U.S. As you mentioned, we sit with a different spectrum position than some of the U.S. players, and in particular, our success on the 700 means we don't think we need to spend anywhere nearly as much as we did on the 700 for the next spectrum auction. I'd hate to venture you know, what a number would look like, but it would be materially less, is our view, as best we could see now. Second part of your question is, if that is the case, are we worried about, I think where you were going, are we worried about one of the new entrants picking up substantial spectrum. In the province of Quebec, we have a network sharing arrangement with Videotron, and so as best we can tell, their aspirations continue to stay centered on the province of Quebec, and so we think that works out well for us with a network sharing arrangement we have with them. In terms of outside of Quebec, whether it's Freedom, Shaw, or anyone else, that's always a bit of a concern, but I would add that spectrum is only one enabler on the network side. There's real tower building that needs and infill that needs to go with that. And as you all know, that's a continuous, expensive journey that they would need to undertake. And so that could be a competitive threat for us, but practically, not sure what it would mean in the immediate or near term. Would it lend itself to a network sharing arrangement? As far as we can see, we think we sit in a pretty healthy spectrum position and healthy network position. That's a strong competitive advantage for us. So entering into a network sharing arrangement, something we don't take lightly, and we'd hate to transfer some of that competitive advantage unnecessarily. Right now, we don't see the need to do that, is the short answer to your question.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. Thank you all.